This is IRIB English Radio.
Iran says progress has been made in talks with the remaining members of the 2015 nuclear deal. French police arrest dozens of people during protests marking International Workers' Day. And Italy reports another 226 coronavirus-related deaths and nearly 13,000 new infections. Hello, everyone, and a very warm welcome to World News. In our top story, Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal have held another round of talks aimed at reviving the accord in Vienna. The joint commission was attended by representatives from Iran, Britain, China, France, Germany, Russia, and the European Union. U.S. Special Rep for Iran, Robert Malley, is also present in the Austrian capital, but there will be no talks between him and the Iranian negotiators. Earlier, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the nuclear talks were an unclear place, but admitted the sides have shown serious willingness to take a pathway back into the deal. That's while Tehran has repeatedly said it will only accept the outcome of talks once Washington removes all sanctions in a verifiable manner. Iran's also made it clear it will not allow negotiations to become attritional. Iran's top nuclear negotiator, meanwhile, says sanctions on Iran's energy sector, including oil, insurance, banking, automobile, and ports, have to be removed, and there is agreement on that. Abbas Araghchi said negotiations continue over a list of individuals and entities which are subject to sanctions. Most of them are supposed to be removed as well. Araghchi says a better understanding is emerging among delegations in Vienna on differences and commonalities.
We had very intensive discussions in the past 4 or 5 days, and I can say that we have been able to make a much better understanding on the issues of difference. On both sides, on both questions of difference and areas that we have a common position, I think now we have a better understanding, and the discussion is now more matured, and we have already started to draft. Now we have some texts available to us based on the negotiations we have already made, and now we are working on the words and phrases and sentences and paragraphs. That is not an easy job. It's very time-consuming job. So this is why we have now that the progress is actually slow, which is quite natural to me. Well, on the details of negotiations, of course, sanctions are a very serious question, and actually the most important question for us. We have already entered into the different aspects of that. It's a very complicated issue, and as you know, sanctions have different categories, and we have to deal with all of them. Of course, what is our guiding principle is the positions, the firm positions taken by the Islamic Republic of Iran, and has been emphasized by the Supreme Leader.
Joining us now out of Brussels is Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst. For more on the story, hello, Elijah. When we hear, the Washington's take on this entire thing, it's always saying that we're very far away from reaching a deal. We're very willing. In action, we see something different coming out of this current administration. Iran says we're not going to stick around and try to hammer this thing out forever. So, and then Iran's always, and also the European signatories are, every time they're having talks, are saying that there's huge leaps being made as far as progress goes. But we're not hearing the same thing in a uniform manner from all sides. Tell us what, in your interpretation, is going on.
Thank you for having me. What's going on, I think, is the heavy sanction that Donald Trump and Mike Pompeo put Iran upon, we're talking about over 1,600, 1,650 sanctions. And what they have done in a very intentional way is to link the sanction not only to the nuclear deal, but also to the acts of terrorism and so on, making the U.S. administration more struggling to lift all the sanctions. So, for example, Iran may be ready to accept that some sanctions will not be lifted on the head of the IRGC or the head of the Basij. That for these people is kind of an honor to be on a U.S. terrorist list. However, sanctions on banking and on oil and gas, automobile, the money that is frozen in the United States, in Japan, in Korea, in Iraq must be released. Therefore, there are still so many details that need to be sorted out, and the timing is important because there is no trust, and the trust is not built now between the U.S. and Iran, and it's not going to be built by the 21st of May. It needs weeks, months, maybe years, but now we're not talking about trust, we're talking about drafting an agreement where both sides are happy, and particularly Iran, because it is the U.S. that left the deal that was signed in 2015, not Iran, and imposed further sanctions. So it is up to the U.S. to lift all these sanctions, particularly the most important one. We're talking about the central bank, we're talking about the selling of oil, etc. So that is up to the U.S. to get on with it and see how the U.S. administration and Biden's team is going to lift all these sanctions to make sure that Iran is happy to full compliance again.
Well, how much power, Elijah, do you think, and how much will do you think is there in Biden's team? Because we know when you're speaking about trust, there's a lot of issues that the U.S. in and of itself is facing within its own partisan issues within the own Democratic Party with respect to the JCPOA, with respect to Republicans, and also with the Israeli lobby, with the Saudis, with their allies. So, you know, how empowered do you think the Biden administration is to stand in the face of all the adversaries it has back on U.S. soil to make this thing happen?
I think this is extremely irrelevant because Iran made it very clear there is no JCPOA plus, there is no consideration to the Democratic or Republican. The Iranians are saying this is none of our business, this is your internal cuisine to deal with. We don't care about who you want to consult in the Middle East. You want to talk to Israel, you want to talk to the Saudi, to the Emirates, that's your own business. Do you want us to comply? You have to lift all sanctions, you have to abide by the deal. There is no plus in it, there are no missiles to talk about. In this particular deal, we don't talk about the Iranian regional power and how Iran had become a power in the Middle East and its presence in different countries. We're talking about, do you comply with the deal that you've signed in 2015 or not? If you don't, we're going to increase our enrichment uranium and make it more pure. We're going from 60 to 90%. And if you do comply, we will comply, but lift all the sanctions and tell us how we can make sure that all the sanctions are lifted and you do your own, sort out your own problem, and then come and tell us that we've done it, and then we can all sit around the table and be all happy. So whatever happened in the U.S., that is not Iran's problem.
Correct, but what I'm trying to get at you is, like, under the Obama administration, Elijah, we saw there was the same opposition, but Barack Obama managed to kind of just steamroll right over that opposition and dive into the JCPOA initially. So now why don't we see the same resolve from the Biden administration to make this thing happen?
Well, first of all, it is not Barack Obama who made the deal. We're talking about negotiation that started at the time of President Ahmadinejad. So the current Iranian government collected all the years of negotiation. And when Obama realized that there is no way out and all the sanctions on Iran were not working, so he signed the deal. What Trump did is he made it almost virtually kind of impossible for the Biden administration to come and remove all the sanctions. This is the problem. The problem is the Biden administration needs to find a way, a layout within the administration, how to speed up things. Otherwise, Iran will continue increasing its enrichment and continue adding more centrifuge. And that is the thing that the Biden administration is aware of. This is why we see that the Americans are giving an impression that they are honest and they are sincere in wanting to lift the sanction. They also trying at the same time to be a bit clever and try to add a few extra points and then to link Iran in here and there. But Iran is saying, either you take it or you leave it. We are not interested in a middle way. So this is why the Biden administration doesn't have really much choice.
Thank you, Elijah. Always a pleasure to have you on from Brussels. Mr. Elijah Magnier joining us, journalist and political analyst. Meanwhile, the UN Human Rights Office has criticized the Bahraini regime's crackdown on a protest at the country's main prison. It's called on authorities now to immediately launch a thorough and an effective probe into violent repression. We have more for you in this following report.
Protests are growing in Bahrain inside and outside prison walls, so is the regime crackdown. On Friday, the UN Human Rights Office described as disturbing the Bahraini regime's use of force to break up a peaceful sit-in at the country's main prison mid-April. OICHR slammed as unnecessary and disproportionate the violent repression of the sit-in at Jao Prison, located south of the capital, Manama. The inmates have been demonstrating against detention conditions, particularly the lack of access to medical treatment. The sit-in started in early April after the death of a political prisoner due to reportedly being denied timely access to essential health care. Outside the prison, Bahrainis have been holding similar protests, calling for the release of political prisoners and better conditions. OICHR says the lack of health care in overcrowded Bahraini prisons has been an issue for years, which has turned into a chronic problem due to the coronavirus pandemic. It says Manama's response to protests has been in the form of more detentions. Thousands of opposition politicians, activists, journalists, and human rights defenders have been imprisoned in Western allied Bahrain since an uprising in 2011 and subsequent years of crackdown. Bahrain's most prominent cleric, Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Qassem, says drawing up a new constitution is the only way out of the political crisis. He has urged the regime to pursue an agreement with the opposition instead of increasingly suppressing the dissidents. That advice is likely to fall on deaf ears, given over 10 years of crackdown. However, with every protest chipping away at the legitimacy and authority of the Al-Khalifa regime, it is only fast-tracking the inevitable, which cannot be suppressed.
Workers and activists across the world have held demonstrations to mark the International Workers' Day, known as May Day. Police have clashed with protesters in the French capital. Police fired tear gas to disperse protesters who were hurling projectiles at police. The protesters also vandalized several buildings and set waste bins on fire. At least 34 people were arrested. Thousands of protesters also marched in other major French cities. They're angry at President Emmanuel Macron's economic reforms and the government's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. Elsewhere, police scuffled with protesters in the Turkish city of Istanbul as well. More than 200 protesters accused of violating corona-related restrictions were arrested. May Day rallies are also held in other countries such as Britain, Germany, and China. Demonstrators demand better working conditions, more jobs, and better wages. Now, at least nine Londoners have been arrested in protests against the government's legislation that would increase police powers. Activists argue the controversial bill, which is working now its way through the House of Parliament, will criminalize the right to protest. Ahmed Caballo went to one of the protests organized in the British capital to get us this report.
Every year on the 1st of May, protesters fill the streets of cities around the world, marching on what's known as May Day, or International Labour Day. Demonstrators usually consist of various groups supporting a wide variety of causes. Yet this year, in the UK, activists joined more than 40 protests throughout the country, centred around one thing: opposition to the controversial Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill, with the main focus of dissent coming from London.
most notable to me were the fact that the police, under the powers of this legislation, and this is new, will be able to say that this demonstration, for example, through the noise that it's causing, is causing a nuisance. And if that nuisance is serious, they will be able to arrest people, fine them up to £10,000, and imprison them.
What will be next? That bill comes through, that's just going to be one of a whole range of new policies and things that will just silence any form of criticism.
The new legislation pending in Parliament could allow police to impose conditions on protests, including start and finish times and the imposition of noise limits. This bill would also allow the police to prematurely end a protest if it caused serious annoyance to the surrounding community, organisation and businesses, which demonstrators argue is the whole point of protests.
This bill makes it impossible to have any kind of strike, any kind of picket that has any effect.
Thousands upon thousands have turned up here to defend the right to protest, something Brits up and down the country feel is under threat.
More than 600 civil society and protest groups have called for the government to drop the legislation, and the mobilisation of protesters on the streets has already forced a planned passage through Parliament to be delayed. Yet only time will tell whether the huge protests up and down the country has successfully defeated the anti-protest bill. Ahmed Gabello, London.
Italy reports another 226 coronavirus deaths and nearly 13,000 new infections. Countries over 121,000 COVID-19 cases now, second highest death toll in Europe following the UK. Elsewhere on the continent, Germany's cases rose by nearly 19,000 and fatalities by 232. Both numbers are down from yesterday. In Russia, authorities reported 9,200 new infections, pushing the total of coronavirus patients there to more than 4.8 million. Meanwhile, Portugal and Spain have banned flights from India. The Asian country is grappling with the world's worst outbreak from COVID-19 right now. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
in the limelight.
Human Rights Watch, HRW, has released a report accusing the Zionist regime of the crime of apartheid. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Yumna Patel Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Human Rights Watch finds Israeli regime guilty of crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Human Rights Watch, HRW, has released a report accusing the Zionist regime of the crime of apartheid. The 213-page report, entitled A Threshold Crossed, Israeli Regime Authorities and the Crimes of Apartheid and Persecution, found that the Zionist regime is responsible for committing crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution in the entire territory under its control, from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. Echoing the findings of leading Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, which released its own report accusing the fake regime of Israel of apartheid earlier this year, the HRW report claims that through discriminatory policies that methodically privilege Israeli Jews over Palestinians under the state's control, Human Rights Watch concludes that the Zionist regime has demonstrated an intent to maintain the domination of Jewish Israelis over Palestinians across the occupied Palestine and the OPT, the group said. While the term apartheid was coined in reference to the system of institutionalized racial segregation that existed in South Africa up until 1990s, the HRW report defines the fake regime of Israel apartheid along the lines of international law, which defines apartheid as a crime against humanity consisting of three primary elements, including an intent to maintain domination by one racial group over another, number two, a context of systematic oppression by the dominant group over the marginalized group, and number three, inhuman acts. The report found that the crime of apartheid is particularly severe in the OPT, where Palestinians live under draconian military rule, while the Zionist Jews live in a segregated manner in the same territory, yet enjoy full rights under Israeli civil law. According to the report, the Zionist regime's crimes of apartheid include a more than decade-long siege on Gaza, the severe restriction of movement of Palestinians in the OPT, the confiscation of more than a third of the land in the West Bank, policies and conditions in the West Bank that has led to forcible transfer of thousands of Palestinians, the denial of residency rights for Palestinians and their relatives in the OPT, and the continued denial of basic civil rights to millions of Palestinians. Across the land that the Zionist regime controls, the report highlighted, the Israeli regime's authorities have sought to maximize the land available for Jewish communities and to concentrate most Palestinians in dense population centers. Such policies, which explicitly label and treat Palestinians as a demographic threat, are most evident in places like Al-Quds, where the cities Israeli municipality has set the goal of maintaining a solid Jewish majority in the city and even specifies the demographic ratios it hopes to maintain, HRW noted. Such discriminatory policies that specifically target Palestinian communities and restrict their livelihoods, coupled with the reality that the state grants Israeli Jews the freedom to move about and live where they please, all contribute to the fake regime of Israel's crime of apartheid. These policies, which grant Jewish Israelis the same rights and privileges wherever they live and discriminate against Palestinians to varying degrees wherever they live, reflect a policy to privilege one people at the expense of another, HRW Executive Director Kenneth Roth said in a statement recently. Similar to its response to Ward Betzalem report released in January, the Israeli regime wrote off the report as propaganda, with the Israeli regime's foreign ministry accusing HRW of demonizing Israeli regime. Human Rights Watch is known to have a long-standing anti-Israel agenda actively seeking for years to promote boycotts against Israel, the foreign ministry said in a statement. The fake regime of Israel's foreign ministry went on to claim that HRW did not share their report for review or comment with the regime, a claim that HRW denies. The report stated that through the passage of bills like 2018 Nation State Law, which claim that the right to exercise national self-determination in Israel is unique to the Jewish people, coupled with increased settlement expansion in recent years, has clarified Israel's intent to maintain the domination by Jewish Israelis. As a result, HRW recommended that individual nations and members of international community should take a number of steps into holding the fake regime of Israel accountable for its crimes against humanity and the crime of apartheid. In its recommendations, HRW suggests that its findings of crimes against humanity should prompt the international community to change its approach toward the Israeli regime and Palestine by moving away from the unending peace process and negotiations and move toward a human rights-based approach centered on accountability. While much of the world treats the Israeli regime's half-century occupation as a temporary situation that a decades-long peace process will soon cure, the oppression of Palestinians there has reached a threshold and performance that meets definitions of crimes of apartheid and persecution, Roth said. Among the group's recommendations are the following: an International Criminal Court, ICC investigation and persecution of those credibly implicated in crimes against humanity and crimes of apartheid. The imposition of individual sanctions, including travel bans and asset freezes on individuals responsible for committing such crimes. Countries should establish a UN commission of inquiry to investigate systematic discrimination and repression in the occupied Palestine. Countries should establish a UN global envoy for the crimes of persecution and apartheid, with a mandate to mobilize international action to end persecution and apartheid worldwide.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all over the world, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to Q&A and Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer questions, doubts, or misconceptions which are being asked or are sent to this radio station with regard to Islamic theology. For this, we try to invite Islamic scholars and speakers from Qom Seminary Schools. Like always, we have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi to help us with his answer to the questions which are going to be asked concerning the holy month of Ramadan. The questions that we have and we shall pose and talk about are mostly in this very session about the holy month of Ramadan. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
The question of the day actually is the continuation of the question that was posed in our last show. So that's why we try to, inshallah ta'ala, continue to talk about and discuss that question again. And what was the question? The question was, what is a good plan or the best plan? What do you recommend for the rest of the days and months that we have in year to be benefited from the blessings of the holy month of Ramadan? So we have only one golden month where Allah's blessings and bounties are showered on his beliefs, on his creatures. Now, how can we actually store these positive energy for the rest of the year? This was the question, and Sheikh Murtada Karimi, Islamic scholar, actually touched upon this issue to some extent, but we left the whole answer to be given and presented to you today. Sheikh Murtada, assalamu alaikum and welcome. We are listening to you, Sheikh.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As I mentioned in the previous program, if we want to continue acting upon what we gain in the holy month of Ramadan, first we need to know what we can gain during this holy month. I mentioned that according to the verse of chapter Baqarah, لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ, reaching taqwa and God-weariness is the main purpose for fasting. And in a narration from the Holy Prophet reads that the best action during the holy month of Ramadan is to be away from maharim Allah, the forbidden actions. Now, there are some other spiritual things that we can gain during the holy month of Ramadan, and then we can have a program for keeping them after the holy month of Ramadan. One of them is the fact that through fasting during the holy month of Ramadan, we are able to be much more careful about the day of judgment. Mm-hmm. In one narration, the Holy Prophet is quoted as saying, وَذْكُرُوا بِجُوعِكُمْ وَعْتَشِكُمْ فِي جُوعَ يَوْمِ الْقِيَامَةِ جُوعَ يَوْمِ الْقِيَامَةِ وَعْتَشَ. So as people being involved during the year in worldly affairs, we may not think about the Day of Judgment a lot, which is very unfortunate. But during the holy month of Ramadan, one of the spiritual gains is that according to this narration, the Holy Prophet says, through your hunger and thirst, remember your thirst and hunger on the Day of Judgment. So this is another spiritual lesson that we can gain during the holy month of Ramadan.
Very true.
Doing ihsan or benevolence, we know that the holy month of Ramadan is the month of paying charity and sadaqah. There are, many narrations about the virtues of giving ihsan, charity, sadaqah during the holy month of Ramadan. We can practice it during the holy month of Ramadan. It can become a habit for us, and then we can continue acting upon that after the holy month of Ramadan. The next point is taking benefit from the dawns, from the sahar during the holy month of Ramadan. Let me share sentences mentioned by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran. He says that in this busy world, if we are not able to take benefit from the time of Sahar or Dawn, we do not have any other time to have a privacy for ourselves, mm-hmm. for our heart, with our God. There is no other time. We are busy. In 24 hours, a couple of hours, we are sleeping. In the times that we are awake, every person has some worldly affairs. So Ayatollah Khamenei continues to say that in the past, we had some opportunities to have such free time, but today, this is the force of the time. We have some new phenomena which were not there in the past. So, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, the only time that we can have a privacy for ourselves and for our hearts between us and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is during Sahar or Dawn. Now, because of the fact that at least, I mean, many Muslims, they, I mean, they get awake before dawn to eat suhoor. Again, it can become a habit for the believers to continue to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So taking benefit from this time is a gracious blessing of the holy month of Ramadan. But many people, unfortunately, from the day of Eid al-Fitr, they continue to get awake from, I mean, after Adhan al-Subh to say the morning prayer. But it would be great if people can practice that during the holy month of Ramadan. And
wake up before Adhan.
Exactly, and to make it into a habit, I mean, doing tahajjud, night vigil. I mean, there are many stories, many statements by the great scholars about the virtues of night vigil. I mean, maybe 10 minutes before Fajr, Adhan, it would be great. And gradually, people can increase the time, inshallah. So it is one of the great blessings of the holy month of Ramadan. Mm-hmm. The next point is reciting the Quran. Again, many Muslims, they do that during the holy month of Ramadan. We know that many people are able, through the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to do a khatm, to recite one juz every day, so that at the end of the month, they are able to read and recite the whole noble book of Quran. For 30 days, we are practicing that. Again, we can turn it and change it into a habit. Not one juz every day, at least 50 verses, according to some narrations. If not able, one page, two pages. I mean, we need to have this connection to the noble book of Quran. Ikhlas or sincerity is another spiritual...
So the next recommendation was to have this constant relation with the Holy Quran, recitation
exactly.
of the Holy Quran.
Yes.
So as it has been recommended to recite at least 50 verses of the Holy Quran per day,
mm-hmm.
at least in other days. While in the holy month of Ramadan, we should not suffice with even one juz of it.
It depends. I mean, although, I mean, if people have the time, we have about the even the scholars. I mean, for the imams of the Ahlul Bayt, for the Prophet, we have in the narrations that they used to, do the khatm of the Quran several times during the holy month of Ramadan. We have the same stories about some of the great scholars. But maybe we can say, of course, this isn't a recommended act, but maybe the minimum which is expected from the believers is to do at least one khatm during the holy month of Ramadan and continue to have this connection with this noble book after the holy month of Ramadan. As I mentioned again, many people, unfortunately, right from the day of Eid al-Fitr, they forget about everything. They forget about paying charity, about... Mm-hmm. Salatul Layl, about reciting the Quran, and so on and so forth.
But Sheikh, this recitation of the Quran is very, I don't know, this is what I understood from the actually text of Hadith, from the tongue of the Hadith, or the language of the Hadith, that a person who does not recite 50 verses of the day will be included in the circle of ignorance, if I'm not mistaken, and the Hadith goes well here. So we have to take refuge to God subhanahu wa ta'ala for this. At least we need to oblige ourselves to recite Quran. As for tahajjud, I have also another point to mention. Is it enough, Shaykh, just to at least practice tahajjud with two rak'ahs, at least slowly, but later on, inshallah, it will become a habit for us and we shall perform the whole thing, I mean, with 11 rak'ahs?
Yeah, when it comes to tahajjud, I mean, the great scholars, they say that, first of all, it should be done in a gradual way, because we have seen some people that they begin by, for example, doing that for 1 hour or half an hour, but after 1 month, they get tired and exhausted, and they stop doing that altogether.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is that it should be gradual. For the first step, people may do that before going to sleep after, Shari midnight. I mean, naturally, between 11, 12 p.m., it is the beginning of Shari midnight, and people can read the Salatul Layl from that time onwards, but it's better to be said before Adhan al-Subh. So in the first step, some people may do that if they are not able to be to get up before Fajr prayer. But then, as you mentioned, the next step would be just waking up. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe for 1 week or 2 weeks, you just try and practice to be able to wake up.
That's true.
Next, just to make a wudu. I mean, it's been mentioned by some of the scholars. Next, just reading and saying two rak'ah prayer, and gradually you would increase that into 11 rak'ahs. And it's very important to be done gradually and not force our heart to do the recommended actions that we are not, inclined toward that. If it is done gradually, we will feel that interest to doing that more and more.
So waking up at that time before Adhan by itself is very important.
Exactly.
And breathing in that in the atmosphere, in the environment actually by itself is actually influential in the human beings, but better to recite two rak'ahs, much more better to recite the whole thing, 11 rak'ahs.
Yes. There are stories, quoted from the great scholars, and they are astonishing, good for the people who are able to practice that. And many scholars of Irfan, they say that without tahajjud, you cannot continue treading the path of spirituality.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. Actually, up until now, you have given us and told us some recommendations on how to keep our connections with the whole month of Ramadan. One, with regard to tahajjud and staying awake before the Fajr, and second, having a constant program for recitation of the Holy Quran, and now we are listening to the rest.
You know, there are many things to learn from the holy month of Ramadan. As I mentioned, the best action is to be away from forbidden acts, reciting the Quran, doing tahajjud, ikhlas and sincerity is one of the blessings of fasting, repentance, tawbah, increasing the willpower. All these are the great, effects and benefits of the holy month of Ramadan. But how we are able to keep doing them after the holy month of Ramadan? We have the concept in Islamic spirituality based on the narrations, and that is the concept of musharata, muraqaba, and muhasabatun nafs. Quickly, I need to explain that.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that we have make reciting the Quran a habit for us during the holy month of Ramadan. I'm talking about a recommended act. You can do that about being away, for example, from backbiting or from telling lies or any other forbidden action. This is an example. We can think of other examples as well.
True.
So after the holy month of Ramadan, every day early in the morning, we do musharata. We say that, oh Allah, I promise you that today I will recite 50 verses of the Noble Book of Quran.
Mm-hmm.
During the day, we do muraqabah. We think about that promise. We do that, and every night before going to sleep, we do muhasabah. We think about our actions, whether I was able to act upon that promise, which could be reciting the Quran or being away from backbiting, and so on and so forth. So if we do that, on a daily basis, gradually we'll see great effects. And it could be confirmed and guaranteed by a nazr, a vow, for example.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if I'm a person suffering from backbiting, during the holy month of Ramadan, I practice that, but then I need a long program after the holy month of Ramadan. After the morning prayer, I say that, oh Allah, I promise you that today I will not backbite at all, for example.
Mm-hmm.
If I do that, I make a vow that for each backbiting, for example, I will fast for one day, or for example, I will pay $10 in charity. During the day, I will do muraqabah. At night, when I think about our actions, for example, I come to see that I have backbitten, for example, once. So I need to fast the following day because of the nab.
Right.
It would be pretty difficult. So the next day, I would be more careful about my action.
Yeah.
Of course, the vow should be in a moderate way. For example, I shouldn't say that I will fast for 2 months if I backbite once, or I will pay $10 in charity. It should be something in a moderate way. So gradually this program of musharata, muraqaba, muhasab will help
us inshallah to
keep the blessings of the holy month of Ramadan.
Are we done with this question, Sheikh?
Yes.
Okay. One more thing I think is good to be added to this, and inshallah finalize the discussion. I think we have some days in a month, except the holy month of Ramadan, that are recommended to be fasting on those days. Again,
exactly.
I think if we keep fasting, for example, 3 days a month,
that's
or at least
true.
1 day per month, it is also another good connection with this holy month.
Yes.
Thank you, dear Sheikh, for your answers and these scholarly answers to the questions and enlightening answers which were given to the questions by you. And you respected listeners, many thanks for staying tuned. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Li Ali wa Husayn wa Hasan. Li Ali wa Husayn wa Hasan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz. Every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Major financial institutions have announced that they have put more cryptocurrencies on their balance sheets as the price of a single Bitcoin, the world's most popular cryptocurrency, rocketed from around $20,000 in December to $65,000 earlier in April of 2021. On 26th of April, though, it traded around $53,000. We now present you an article written by Joseph Dana, the senior editor of Exponential View, a weekly newsletter about technology and its impact on society. The piece is titled Face It, Cryptocurrencies Now Mainstream. The article has appeared on the front page of Syndication Bureau website. Please stay with us for more of Joseph Dana's article. Cryptocurrencies have had an amazing time this year. It's no longer a question of whether they can gain mainstream acceptance. We've long since passed that point. Driven by fears of inflation and easy-to-understand trading platforms, cryptocurrencies now are part and parcel of a changed global monetary system. The challenge is how governments and their regulators react. Which countries will appreciate the technology that enables cryptocurrencies, and how will they incorporate them into their financial system? And which will instead simply turn up their nose and pretend they don't exist? The way we store and record value has long reflected the nature of our economy and trading system. In ancient times, we bartered goods. Then we used precious metal coins to store and exchange value. The invention of paper money saw a further evolution in reflecting value backed by physical commodities. While fiat currency is a creation of the modern globalized financial system. Finally, in an age increasingly defined by digital technology, cryptocurrencies, of course, make imminent sense. There is no shortage of recent events contributing to the mainstream of cryptocurrencies this year. Coinbase, the largest crypto exchange in the United States, listed its shares on NASDAQ recently. Meanwhile, major financial institutions have announced that they have put more cryptocurrencies on their balance sheets. As the price of a single Bitcoin, the world's most popular cryptocurrency, rocketed from around $20,000 last December to $65,000 in April. On 26th of April, though, it traded around $53,000. Elon Musk's electric vehicle company Tesla bought roughly $1.5 billion worth of bitcoins and announced it will soon allow customers to purchase cars using that cryptocurrency. Dogecoin, which started as a joke based on a meme of a Shiba Inu dog, has gone up 8,100% this year. The total value of Dogecoins in circulation currently is around $50 billion, more than the market capitalization of the hospitality company Marriott, or Ford, the car maker. While Dogecoin and other cryptocurrencies have seen wild price swings recently, the reason for that volatility may in fact soon give rise to greater stability. The steep rise in prices has been because of more people and institutions investing in cryptocurrencies. But as more and more people and institutions become invested in cryptocurrencies, the more mature and stable cryptocurrencies become. Bitcoin has swung in the past month between about $50,000 and $65,000, a difference of 30% from the lower value. By any account, that is a massive price swing. But given the amount of institutional money pouring into Bitcoin, coupled with global interest, the price has been roughly stable within this range. Those who have watched Bitcoin evolve over the past 10 years would have expected much greater volatility. In fact, it is reasonable to expect the trading range eventually to narrow. Still, despite the rise in prominence of cryptocurrencies, there is no unified government approach towards cryptocurrencies. The administration of President Joe Biden in the United States claims it will introduce new regulations for cryptocurrencies, but it remains unclear what these new regulations will be. Meanwhile, China, which has strict laws regulating the use of cryptocurrencies, just announced it will launch its own digital currency. Built on similar technology as Bitcoin, the digital yuan could prove to be a model for governments worldwide. At the other end of the spectrum, India is mulling laws that will in effect ban cryptocurrencies altogether, part of a larger campaign to curtail the open internet. In short, government's response to cryptocurrencies is confused. On the other hand, financial markets are being stymied. Wall Street jumped on the cryptocurrency bandwagon this month, but it did so without actually trading any cryptocurrencies. For while participants in the United States markets have been hankering for an exchange-traded fund for cryptocurrencies, the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, still won't allow this. For all its virtues, Coinbase remains only a proxy. Its stock value is closely tied to the direction of prices of popular cryptocurrencies. One argument that cryptocurrency skeptics have used against coins like Bitcoin is that, at a practical level, they are too slow to trade. A transaction on the Bitcoin blockchain can take anywhere from 15 minutes up to an hour, depending on the volume of transactions. In the real world, though, no one is going to wait 15 minutes to pay for a cup of coffee. Such arguments are valid, but they fail to acknowledge the fact that cryptocurrency is a metacurrency. You store value in it, but you will likely still exchange it into dollars, dirhams, bahts, and so on to buy your coffee or to transfer funds. Let me provide a personal example. I regularly remit money from the United States to South Africa, where my wife and I live. In the past, it would require calling my American bank, paying hefty fees, and waiting a couple of days for the money to arrive in South Africa. Now I purchase stable cryptocurrencies that are pegged to the price of the US dollar and thus don't have price volatility like Bitcoin. There are many so-called stable coins. I use one called USD Coin. It takes a second to buy any amount of stable coins on my crypto exchange. Then I send them to my wife's crypto wallet in South Africa. The whole process takes just minutes, and the fees are normally less than $2. Moreover, I can do it all on my cell phone with a couple of taps. The recent announcement that the Canadian digital asset management firm 3iQ will list a Bitcoin fund on Nasdaq Dubai is another step in the right direction. First, it demonstrates that the United Arab Emirates is lowering its resistance to cryptocurrencies and embracing the technology for what it is, an integral part of the future of finance. Next, the Dubai listing follows the fund's listing on the Toronto Stock Exchange last year and may lead to other listings in places like Singapore, Taiwan, Sweden, and the United States, potentially allowing for 24-hour trading in the fund and thus greater price discovery. To paraphrase the Nobel laureate Bob Dylan, governments should get out of the way of cryptocurrencies if they can't lend a hand. For the times, they're truly a changing.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.